So we're delighted that Linda is here in this series we've been looking at associated with vocation and service. And I know that she's going to speak about and help us reflect a bit on discernment. Bernard Cook, the great Jesuit scholar that I had the pleasure of working with many years ago, wrote a marvelous book on the church. And if I had my life to do over again, I would spend more time studying the nature of the church, the ecclesia. Not its history, but what that idea means in the history of Christian culture. And in that, he points out that in the first three centuries of the church, it was, well, not universal, quite normal for the episcopus, the bishop, to be chosen from the community. Obviously, who else is going to do it in the first three centuries? And that there was, in that process of choosing, two things that the community in general bore in mind. Two gifts, if you will. And the first gift, they wanted somebody with the gift of discernment. They wanted someone who could discern the gifts within the community. Leadership was about discerning the gifts in the community and the needs within the life of the world. And I remember when I first read this, I said, well, the gift of discernment, Satan has that really well down. And certainly a number of directors of the Provincial Museum of Alberta had it too. But they never wanted to put it together. They discerned in order to keep separation, because they thought that's where their power came from. But the second gift they had was, or sought in a men and women of that day, and I include women because, I don't know if you all know this, but abbesses are equal to bishops in the Roman Catholic tradition and the Orthodox tradition. And they may not elect the Pope or the Patriarch, but certainly within their particular world, they have that status. So the second gift was the will to put together the gifts and the needs of the world. And I suppose it is that that's informed our asking various people, both this last fall, or this term, as well as this next term, to actually reflect on us, with us, on their work and how they've gone about things. Because we've seen that operating in the lives of many of you here in Camrose. So I'm delighted that you're going to do this with us. Thank you.
As we start, look around the room. Just look around. I'm serious. Look around the room. Are these not remarkable people? Isn't it a huge privilege to be in this group? If we do not see God's living presence, it's because we have not looked deeply enough. These aren't my words. I would never be so arrogant. They're the words of Pope Francis. And for me, I saw them in the Missalette and I thought, that points directly to what we're here for today, to look deeply individually and together. Look at the presence we have in this room. How can we not see God's living presence? It's radiating out of every person. But what I propose to do is to take half an hour to go through a discernment process. And I don't know if you're familiar with it or if it's the first time, But I just ask you to go with it, to enter into it. And then after the first half hour of actually going through a process of discernment, then we'll take time for discussion and questions and so forth. Is that okay? Now, the other thing is, probably the things I'm going to be doing might be puzzling to some people. But if you have any questions, if you could hold them until we get to the end, then I'll be happy to talk about them. Would that be all right? And just be able to stay with the questions, be able to stay with, well, what does she mean? Is this, are we doing this right? If you could just stay with it and hold it, there will be time to talk about it later. Is that okay? All right. So, I don't know. Can you hear me if I sit? Is that all right? Everybody can see? All right. Then that just feels a little more comfortable than standing. The topic for today is discerning the living presence. Now, what do we mean by discern? Libraries have been filled with books on discernment. And I'm not going to go into a long discussion of discernment. But what I mean, and for our context today, is to look deeply. To look deeply, and in this series, this is the last of the series, to consider our vocation, to consider our call. And in the little process we're about to go through, hopefully it will open our awareness and expand our consciousness so that we can search, so that we can see, that we can hear in a way that we might not have before. The other thing we're going to do is we're going to take some time with Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who uses spiritual language. So we're going to experiment a little bit with spiritual literacy, which are necessary tools to be able to see deeply. It is sounding like we agree with Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, and I quote, "The flash of the living presence that opened our eyes remains as a light imprinted deep within." These experiences are imprinted in us, in every cell of our being. They never leave us. We may stop thinking about it, but they continue to work in us and through us. Now, I don't know how many people are familiar with Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. Anybody familiar with him? A few. He was a scientist, a paleontologist to be exact, who was involved in a terrible controversy that they're still arguing about, and that was, 100 years ago. He was a theologian. He was a Jesuit. And he was a mystic. And when he was a stretcher bearer in the First World War, it became urgent to him to write down these experiences of the living presence. And so he wrote them down in the form of letters to his cousins. And I'm reading from a book of the collection of those first writings of Tyar. Now, I'm going to read them to you. This is the real nitty-gritty discernment stuff. And I'm going to read a passage two times. And the reason that I'm going to read it two times is because it's unfamiliar language. He's using metaphors. He's using spiritual literacy. So that as you're listening to it, you meet it in a different way, more like the way you would meet poetry that Barry was talking about. So this is the language of spirit. That is the kind of bridge between our consciousness and the language of our soul, which is beyond consciousness. So these words are just little bridges for us. So I invite you to enter into the listening in a way that is expansive and open. So the first time I read it, what kind of helps is to look for a particular word or phrase that kind of catches your attention. Don't go for every word in it. Don't think it. Don't analyze it. Just see what catches your attention. It could be because it confuses, or it could be because it's, he's finally said it, what I experience. It could be anything in between. So, I will begin. It is not enough for a person to throw off self-centeredness and to live as a social being. He needs to live with his whole heart in union with the totality of the world that carries him along cosmically. Deeper than the soul of individuals. Vaster than the human group. There is a vital spirit of things. There is something absolute that draws us, yet lies hidden. If we are to see its features, to answer its call, and to understand its meaning. And if we are to learn to live more, we must plunge boldly into the vast current of things and see whither its flow is carrying us. Now, if there is something that caught your attention, a word or a phrase, in the second reading, let that be as a kind of a guide to help you to get an understanding of this description of vocation, of call. It is not enough for a person to throw off self-centeredness and live as a social being. He needs to live with his whole heart. In union with the totality of the world that carries him along cosmically. Deeper than the soul of individuals. Vaster than the human group. There is a vital fluid or spirit of things. There is some absolute that draws us, yet lies hidden. If we are to see its features, to answer its call and understand its meaning, and if we are to learn to live more, we must plunge boldly into the vast current of things and see whither its flow is carrying us. Now I'll give you 2 minutes of silence. To discern, how does this description of the living presence relate to your life, to our world? Don't think. Allow insights to come. And I'll let you know when the 2 minutes of silence are up. Thank you. Thank you. All right. The meditation we did at the beginning, I find is a very accessible spiritual exercise, and it's very helpful. I mean, it's great even when you're standing in a long line in the grocery store. It's, you know, or talking to TELUS, for example. Well, that's what I'm saying. It's a wonderful opportunity to get in touch with the living presence. So that's why I shared that meditation with you. And it comes from the Buddhist tradition. And it's this wonderful little book called Being Peace. It's in this book. As well as an invitation and a little journey of becoming peace in our world, which is why we do this, isn't it? Okay, the other is this book, and this book for me fell into my hands when I was studying for my final exams for my BA, and I read it all night long, passed the exam the next day, only out of compassion of my professor, but truly, but this book has been a template or rubric for my life. I've been through it many, many times. It's a touchstone for me. And for the first time, I was able to read in words my lived experience. So that's why when David asked me to do this, I obviously looked up to see what Pierre had to say about vocation, about call, and that was the starting point. So I've got another book, The Future of Man. Originally, I had all his books. I noticed in my travels that we're down to these two. This one I've bought many times because when it disappears, I just replace it. And I don't know why this one's still with me. I don't know. Anyway, it still is. Pardon? Well, yeah. So is there any questions that you have or any comments or that you would like to share with the whole group?
I wondered, Linda, if you could speak a little bit about the coming into your own vocation and how you understand that.
Oh, that's so interesting, Dawn. As soon as you said that, I came into my own vocation probably before I was 2 years old. And this was one of my mother's favorite stories, that I wouldn't let people sit on either side of me because that was God's place. And the relatives on my father's side thought that that was cool. The relatives on my mother's side thought that I was a very disturbed child. But
as usual, mothers are right.
But my parents told people, if she says that's God's place, that's God's place. And they supported my vocation from my earliest memories. And I can never think of a time where I wasn't aware of God's presence around me. And through my life, this presence has taken me to many surprising places, never of my choice and never by my plan. It's the way it is.
Want to get some more details? Probably don't know what you're saying.
Oh. Here I am, eager to hear your story, but I guess that's a fair question, Dietmar. I was born and raised in Winnipeg and lived there until I came to Camrose. And in David and my discussion, that came up. And why did I come to Camrose? And because from the moment I came here because of being a colleague with Dawn, having Jane as a student in our very first residency in the Prairie Jubilee program, that's a credit course, or was a credit course for the Faculty of Theology at the University of Winnipeg. So that's why I came to Camrose. When I came to Camrose, I came for a workshop at Nola's house. And I was struck by the quality of hospitality of the people here. And then I went out to walk along the trails, and I knew this is where I belonged. So I moved here. God said, I moved. So that's how I came to Camrose. And even David Goa, the esteemed David Goa, admits that this is a Mecca. Camrose is a Mecca. Oh, that. Okay, well, I I've been very involved all my... I've been a teacher all my life. And I was really involved with how people learn, how the brain works, and in creating learning environments. And that's so my teaching career was that. Anyway, it came time for my first retirement. And I retired and completed my Master of Divinity degree that began in 1986 and from which I graduated in 2001. They're very patient. Began at the University of Manitoba in the Religious Studies Department with Gordon Harland as a wonderful professor, and then switched to my Master of Divinity was in a spiritual formation. So there. So that's not Lesotho yet, but everybody that knows me knows that my answers are long and convoluted. So bear with me. We will get to the end of that question. So that was my first retirement. When I took 2 years of immersed myself in study, and it was pure bliss. I loved being able to have that time to just immerse myself in a learning community. The Faculty of Theology, it was the golden years of the Faculty of Theology. Wonderful professors, wonderful people from all, we were a consortium from different denominations. So my sister gave me the gift of a Mediterranean cruise to celebrate after I handed in my last paper. And when I came back, there was a message from the school that I taught at, St. Mary's Academy, that I should call. Anyway, the next day I was back teaching again. So after a 2 week respite, I was back. And it ended up that I was back there for 5 years. And I went there on the condition that I taught only the Old Testament and through the eyes of biblical women. So that was a complete pleasure. And then one day, the provincial was outside my classroom door, and I walked out the door, and she said, you know, how are things going? And I said, kind of wondering what I'm doing. And she said, would you consider going to Lesotho and to work with our novices, the community, Sisters of the Holy Names of Jesus and Mary? Now, I've been affiliated with the Sisters of Jesus and Mary, and then I'm associate of that community since 1986. But they taught me from the time I was 15 years old. And I had a spiritual director that stayed with me until I went to Africa and helped prepare me to be able to do spiritual formation in Africa. The provincial had been a close friend for many, many years. And she wanted the community in Africa whose formation had gone back to just post-Vatican II. And the community is now part of an NGO that the members are a part of an NGO that is raising consciousness about the living presence. And so she wanted them to be exposed. She wanted me to teach the Prairie Jubilee program in Lesotho. And I thought, well, okay, this is going to be a bit of a challenge. So we thought it would probably take 2 years. So I went to Lesotho and stayed with the sisters and lived in a little village called Peka. Lesotho is a tiny little mountain kingdom completely surrounded by South Africa. And I taught, I was with every single member of the community I lived with these young girls just out of high school that were postulants in the community. I was with them 12 hours a day. I gave lessons daily to the novices. There was a select group of 20 people that I was to train as spiritual directors. And then there was people at different stages of their formation where I gave workshops. And then one of the sisters came up and asked me if I would do the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius with her. Peter knows a little bit about that. And so I thought, well, yeah, that's fine. I mean, it's part of spiritual direction training. She wanted to do that. Anyway, one Sunday we arranged a time, and she brought a whole group, her CLC group, Christian Life Community, that were the leadership of people that were following the Ignatian spiritual exercises. And so those people drove an hour and a half every second Sunday for 30 weeks, and we went through the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. But you have to understand, there it's an oral culture. They do not have very many books, and certainly no books that had anything to do with what I was teaching them, which ranged from the Enneagram to Catholic social teachings, to methodology for spiritual direction and supervision. They had no background and no books. They're Basutu. And the church is very encultured in our little district. And every spiritual exercise that I did with them, because of their profound spirituality, they turned into an art form. Added dance, added music, and they poetically are able to express the presence of the living God so naturally and easily. I was in awe the whole time I was there. So the first year, I taught them everything I knew, as much as was possible, and they struggled on. Remember that the Susutu is their first language, that the language of instruction and government and business is English, because it was a British protectorate, thank God, or they would have been wiped out either by the Boers. They are innocent because they never experienced apartheid directly, because they were protected by the British from that. The British didn't leave until apartheid ended. So there's an innocence. They're a tribal people. I'd been studied with the Bat Kol Institute in Israel just before I went to Lesotho. In fact, I flew from Israel to London to Maseru to get to Lesotho, which is, I don't know if you know the geography, I flew northwest to go southeast. It was horrendous. and eventually got there. But anyway, so that's a little bit about my background with my time in Lesotho. 2 years. The second year, the provincial there, like when I first got there, I went to her and I said, all right, you know, I was ready and eager to start. And I said, what would you like me to do? And she said, what do you want to do? So it took a little while to sort that out. And eventually we agreed with the provincials in the different houses. And we came up with a plan, and we went through the plan. And, oh, we had the most glorious graduation ceremony that lasted all day and was a huge feast. And it was amazing. And gifts from all the different communities. And it was so much like the potlatch. It was like that because it's a tribal culture, indigenous people are indigenous people everywhere and very similar to indigenous people in Canada. But, you know, one thing, after studying with the Bat Kol Institute in Jerusalem, we did the Book of Exodus. When I went to Israel, I went to a culture that was a biblical culture. It was like stepping right back into the Old Testament. And I know what a shepherd is. So when I study the Old Testament, which is my hobby, I'm back in the Sutu. So.
And then you worked in Winnipeg to support affordable housing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That was another thing. Oh, yeah. So before I went to Lesotho, I decided, okay, this is a new start, and I gave away or sold everything I had because I wanted to be available wherever God. I didn't want to be tied down to anything. When I was finished in Africa, I had no idea what was coming next. I mean, Africa was enough of a surprise. And so I came back to Winnipeg after being in Lesotho for 2 years. And much to my surprise, I ended up in a failed social experiment. No, thank you, not right now. It was... The city planners initiated this project. The architects and designers at the University of Manitoba were involved. The West Broadway Community Association was involved. The Cooperative Housing Federation of Canada, Department of Health and Social Services, all these people came together to come up with a model cooperative, a community that was inclusive of people with different needs, a sustainable community. So they came up with this absolutely gorgeous building that was built right downtown. And it was had environmentally had a very low environmental footprint. It was beautiful, and here it was right downtown in the middle of an area that most people are afraid to live in. Darcy stayed in my apartment and experienced the adventure of living in that neighborhood. So they got the money together from all different levels of government and community support and built this building. And there were four apartments that were for wheelchair people. There were four apartments that were accessible, mobility accessible apartments. There were four apartments that were three bedroom apartments, and they were designated for refugee families. And then the rest of the apartments there, it was 24 apartments. The rest of the apartments were to be for community people that low-income people. And the idea was that the people would work together because it's a co-op and there was the support of all of these community services, that it was a co-op where people would live together and create a sustainable, safe, respectful, helpful living experience. Well, what happened was it got into the hands of unscrupulous people and it crashed. $4 million. And this dream crashed. So my friend, I didn't know what to do. There was no other clear thing to do. And so my friend was on the board, and so she asked me if I would go and live there. And I am happy to say that it took 2 years, but we were able to get a board together of responsible people that really did administer the building with help from all of these associations, I will add. We did form bylaws, which is very tricky in a co-op. If anybody's ever worked in a co-op, forming bylaws is extremely difficult because these are the rules which we agree to live by. So to get that, and the other thing was that there were 3 apartments that were designated for people with mental illness. So you can imagine the mix of people in that building. We were able to get a strong and effective and respected board. We were able to pass bylaws. We got a grant to create a garden, a wonderful garden that was designed for people with mobility issues, with people from different backgrounds, and they were so proud of that. There was a gardening co-op that came in and helped build it, and we were chosen to be the model apartment building for composting. So we got the materials and they did workshops in our co-op. So it did happen in those 2 years. But what can I say? I didn't feel that I was authentic in that place, that while I lived there, that vision and that model was very dependent on me. And so, like in Africa, my time period seemed to be 2 years. And then I was invited to come to Camrose, and I did.
Was that 2 years ago?
3 years ago. No! Oh, don't even say it. Don't even. What a horrible thought. But yeah, on the other hand, I taught at the same school I graduated from.
How do you like that?
That's there great. You go. Okay, so.
We're going to have to sort of bring this formally to a close here in a few minutes. Can I just ask you to reflect on one thing that strikes me from Thierry Desjardins' text? And I suppose it's something that is a little bit, I've thought about a little bit over the years. And it's an area that I think often is a little confusing. At least for young people, and maybe for others, maybe for those of us that reach the end of particular periods in our life as well.
What I hear in Desjardins has absolutely nothing to do with career. At all. In fact, he begins in the lovely text that you read by speaking about getting beyond self-interest, beyond a sense of yourself. I hear it a little bit from a kind of Eastern patristic tradition which sees the great human vocation as putting yourself back, your consciousness back in relationship to the divine energy. So I was wondering if you would just say a little bit in conclusion about this relationship as you see it between vocation and the discernment about vocation as reflected in Desjardins, and I think I see echoed in your own life, and career, and what you end up doing. What's the relationship? Or what isn't the relationship?
It's hard to answer that question. Maybe this will give an idea. I never filled out a job application in my whole life. When I went into the Faculty of Education, I took a summer course, and then I got this package in the mail saying that I was accepted into the Faculty of Education. I did not apply. Mm-hmm. My professor did, because she was starting an experimental course, and pulled out my transcript and everything. And these days, you would not be able to do that. Mm-hmm. The way I got involved with the MDiv program at the Faculty of Theology was I was taking a course in spiritual formation, in spiritual direction, with the Benedictine monastics at St. Benedict's on the edge of Winnipeg. And somebody in the course told me that if I registered at the Faculty of Theology, that I would get a tax credit. Well, the course was very expensive, and I thought a tax credit would be a good idea. So I went to talk to the dean, and he had me fill out these forms and stuff. And I thought, well, you know, for tax credits, you need to, you know, they need to have a lot of information. Anyway, I get a package in the mail saying that the Senate had accepted me into the Master of Divinity program. Being a Catholic, I didn't even know what a Master of Divinity program was.
It's because you assumed you were divine.
Well, I mean, so I, you know, that's how I started my career of teaching in the school system, mm-hmm. and then how this shift in career mm-hmm. to spiritual formation mm-hmm. came. It wasn't, mm-hmm. it may look like a career, but it never, it just seemed that one, I'm prepared for something, and then something happens.
Mm-hmm. I have a comment about that. Yeah. So I spent 7 years doing career development with people from all ages and all walks of life, interesting work. What I learned was that career actually means path of the heart, and to be employed means to be engaged with the path of your heart. So in that way, when I began to talk to, you know, men and women that in all walks of life that worked at the, you know, what is now, I don't even know what, the steel mill and oil riggers, and about that, they were engaged in the path of their heart, which I think Linda's talking about, but it's the same thing. And I really appreciate what I think yeah. both of you have said in the shift times, to take time and engage with that.
which I don't know that we have a real luxury to do, but I think it's possible.
Lovely. Well, thank you so much, Linda. Really nice to listen and to go through the exercise with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.